pretty good mileage.
She had an appointment this morning with the dentist, and she was going to try to get it changed so she could make one trip, but then she didn't. And so I said, oh, well, I can't let you drive me all the way over there. Two trips to Elkins in one day, but she insisted, so she's pretty hard to say no to. Plus, she has to come again tomorrow.
I first met Cleta Long probably a month or so. I know exactly the date. I have it written down, but I'm just guessing that it was about a month, wouldn't you say, after the flood?
Mm-hmm.
They were living in the home of a friend of theirs at that time, since their own home had been you might say, destroyed by the flood. It hadn't been washed clear away, but it was inhabitable. And I had seen Cleta's poetry in the newspaper, at least one poem, I guess I'd seen, in the newspaper, and was struck not only by the beauty of the poetry, but by the vision that it gave. In Tucker County at that time, people were really confused and lost. They had lost everything. Some of them had lost family members. There was a sense of purpose, and there was a sense of being lost all at the same time. And so this particular poem offered a vision for people to begin organizing their lives along the reorganizing their lives along the lines of gratitude, I thought, and in addition to just being a very powerful story. So I went to visit with Cleta and her husband, Norman, and Norman's aunt, Edith, was there that night and told some remarkable stories too, and sang some old children's ballads to me. I thought she was a great singer, so we had a real nice evening. And since that time, I've learned more about her poetry. I've been treated to some poetry she wrote before the flood, and now she seems to be in a period of great blooming creativity. She's writing a great deal, and her poems continue to offer a vision for the county and even for a wider audience now, as some of her poems have been published in the paper here, and she's reaching a wider audience, which I know she wants to do. And I was wondering if you would be just willing to talk to the class a little bit tonight. Maybe they've seen the pictures here. Maybe you could just start out by talking about what you were doing on November 4th. I don't know. Wherever you feel like starting.
Okay. Well, I hope I don't bore some of you that were here last week. But we lived across the river from Hendrix, and the water came up over our road lots of times. There was a section that was real low, and so the river would come up and cover this section of road, and maybe for 3 days to a week or something like that, we would be shut in. But we were fine because our house was across the field and up over a bank, well, actually two small banks and then a field, and the water had never been in our house before, so we thought we were safe as long as we had enough to eat and that sort of thing, you know. So on the morning of November 4th, we knew the water was going to come up over the road, and We hurried out to town and bought the food that we thought we would need to do us, you know, for a week in case we were shut in. And I washed my clothes while I was out because it was pouring the rain down, and dried them at the laundromat and took them home. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sure enough, the water came over the road. And that evening, about 6, something like that, my husband went to feed the horse, and the water was, you know, fine. There wasn't any problem. And he came back in, and right around 7 o'clock, my son called me, and he worked at Kingsford Charcoal Plant in Parsons. And he said, "Mom, are you all okay?" He said, "The water is coming in the charcoal plant." And I said, "Oh, sure, we're fine. We're in here, but, you know, we couldn't get out, but we were fine." And so he asked me to call his wife and tell her that to keep checking the creek behind their house at Holly Meadows. So after I got off the phone with him, I called her. And while I was talking to her, we heard this roaring, just, you know, just like a, really like a train. And my husband said, "What in the world is that?" And I said, "I don't know. We thought maybe it was raining that hard." So he looked out the window and couldn't see a thing. And I got off the phone, and we got a light and went out, and the water was coming down through our field. And it was washing the car right out of the driveway. So my husband jumped in the car and got it started, but the back end of it had already washed out into the field so that it wouldn't go. And by this time, the water was coming over the hood of it, you know, and the motor stalled, of course. So he ran to the garage and got a rope, and by the time he got the rope around the bumper, the water was going over top of the car. And you know, the barbed wire fence broke loose, and the apple trees were falling over, and he threw the rope at me to wrap around a tree. There are two big pine trees right beside of our house. And he ran to get his horse. It was a large draft horse. He weighed around 1,700 pounds. He was a Percheron. And he ran to get him out of the barn, but the water, of course, was probably like maybe 5 foot deep, and the horse, maybe even more than that, I really don't know. But it was deep enough that it was washing the horse. And the horse was fighting the water trying to get out, but he couldn't get out. It was so swift it washed him right toward the center of the river, and we saw him wash away. And my husband had raised him from a colt, so this was really difficult for him to handle, you know. So there just wasn't anything we could do. And I felt sure that it was coming up to the house because it, you know, it was just like a wall of water had come down all at one time. We felt that at the upper end of the field, the debris must have been piled up, and then it broke loose and all came down through at once. You know, it must have been dammed up. But I had some furniture on the porch that I was working on for people. I strip and refinish furniture. And I knew we had to get that in the house because if the water came up to the porch, it would wash it away. So we pulled that in the house and tied the truck fast to these trees also. We had an old pickup truck and we tied it fast. And my husband changed clothes, and I said, "It's coming on in the house. We're going to have to get out of here." "Oh," he said, "I don't think so." And I said, "Yes, I bet it's coming through behind the house right now." And he took the light and went out and looked, and sure enough, it was coming around behind the house so that we were, you know, kind of getting trapped in there. And we just grabbed a blanket and a package of cookies, and he took his guns, of course, and wrapped them in a garbage bag, and we started across the garden behind the house. And the water was so swift that he had to get on the lower side of me, and I had braced my leg against his to stand up because I have a muscular dystrophy type disease and I can't balance myself very well anyway. But we made it across the garden, and by this time there were, like, you know, big poles washing down through there. So we went in the calf barn and we stayed there for a few minutes, and the water came even in there. This was clear over against the side of the hill. So we decided that we would go around the mountain and try to get to my husband's aunt's house. It's about a mile down the road, but it's about 3 miles around the mountain. And in the night, with all that rain, that wasn't an easy task for me. But we really weren't thinking straight, because there are two pretty good-sized streams between our place and hers. The first little stream was only about 3 foot wide, and my husband jumped it, but I had to step into it. So I told him, "Now you hold on," because it was really swift, you know, just rolling. But I felt that it would probably only be about to my knees. But when I stepped in, I went up to my armpits, and my cane went flying down the creek. And if he hadn't have been really holding on tight to me, I'd have been in the drink in a couple of minutes, because, or a couple of seconds. And he couldn't pull me out. I just had to sort of wash out, you know, to the edge, and then he helped me up. But we went around that mountain all the way to where we could see across the last little creek. Was now about 12, 15 foot wide, and it was like that too, just rolling. And we could see the lights in his aunt's house, and we could see the barn, and we couldn't get across this creek. So we turned, well, we sat down there for a while, and Norman went up the stream and down the stream, both trying to find a place to cross it, but there wasn't any way we'd get across it. And we didn't know what to do, because we were, you know, I was soaking wet, of course, from the jump go, and by this time he was wet through too, and the wind started to blow, and it was really cold. So we thought back in the cornfield he'd left some fodder, which is just the corn cut down, you know, and stacked up and tied into a fodder shock. And we decided we'd go back to that fodder shock, that it would give us some protection, you know, from this. So we went back, and by this time we were practically numb, and we just made a shelter and crawled in this fodder shock, and the dog crawled in with us too. And we stayed there till morning, and then we got up and went back to our house. And the water was still probably 5 foot deep all the way around the house. We couldn't get near it. And so we had no choice except to turn and go back again, back around the mountain. But by this time the runs had gone down till we could get to his aunt's house about 1 o'clock the next afternoon. And so we stayed there for 10 days, and then we went to the house that Michael was talking about, and we stayed there until the 11th of January, and then we finally rented a house, and we built another house at the farm up a little higher where the water couldn't get to us, or we hope it won't ever get that high. If it does, I'll just forget the whole thing and move to the middle of town. Well, town wasn't much better though, was it? I'll find a hill somewhere. Our house was still standing because of those two big pine trees that we had tied the car and the truck fast to. The debris piled up against those and kept the water from, you know, hitting it really hard, so that all it did was just wash the foundation out from under two sides, and of course it drove one wall in a little bit, and it ruined the floors. It pushed them up. At one place there was a hole broke up through the floor, and it broke the septic tank, and all that ran back underneath. So we felt that it'd be a lot easier to build a house than it would to fix that one. And that's what we did. We had a lot of help from people, financially and labor-wise. The man who laid the blocks for our house and put up the structure charged us $800. And normally he would have charged someone, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 for maybe even more for the same job. And a lot of our friends came in and helped. And so we're back in our house, and it isn't finished, but we're comfortable. So I think that's true with a lot of people in Tucker County. They really appreciated the help that people gave to help us get back to where we are now. I wrote a poem about the night in the fodder shock, and I read it last week, so maybe I'll read the other one that I wrote this week. After I wrote the first one about staying in the fodder shock all night, Mike came over and listened to this one, and then he asked me to write another one that sort of told the different places that the flood hit. So I wrote this one that I entitled The Flood of 85. And it pretty well says the same story, except that it leaves out some of the details of the night in the fodder shock. Let me tell you of Tucker County, the place where I was born, in the wilds of West Virginia, by nature so grandly adorned. In a beautiful emerald valley flanked high by mountains tall, McGowan Green and Backbone by the settlers they were called. And down in this winding valley a river runs brisk and clean, but why they named it Dry Fork is the wonder of any man's dream. For many old folk here have told me, not once can memory recall of Dry Fork being empty and flowing not at all. Now along both sides of the river rich bottom land it lay for the settlers and the farmers when by chance they passed this way. So they claimed the lush green meadows, built their homes and then small towns, and for many years so peaceful there the river kept its bounds. Well, we lived and played in that beautiful land as a child, and when we grew up we bought a farm, a horse and a cow, and even a frolicky pup, and we all lived there by the riverside with never a worry or care, till a flood came down on a November eve and washed away all we held dear. They say that a cloudburst far up in Canaan rolled down Cabin Mountain, the river to claim. Down every steep mountain small rivulets did grow, getting larger and larger with each added flow, till they came to old Dry Fork, now swollen and full, and it rushed past our farm like the charge of a bull. But our house set up high on a rise in the field, rode meadow and orchard between, and the thought of it reaching even near to the door was foolish, or so it did seem. But when the great Dry Fork fed more than its hold by the mountain so rugged and steep, rushed down narrow valley and widened its path, I'm thankful we weren't fast asleep. For up o'er the road through the orchard and field to the driveway to wash off the cars, then on in the house across the garden behind, it came like the flames of a fire. Leaping higher and higher, incensed by the fuel of rain that had fallen for days, consuming each object with angry abandon that happened to be in its way. When it passed to the Black Fork River just outside of Hendrickstown, it pushed it aside, and the waters had naught but to make a new course and around. Through Hendricks it swirled and twisted its way, washing houses and bridge from its path. Then into old Brooklyn Heights bottoms it gathered more bounty to dash. On an island beside town of Hamilton, both rivers so violently met, swept on through the nursery bottom, and their fury was not finished yet. They roared together, and Parsons fell prey to the torrent that rushed through the streets and viciously robbed every store of its wares, leaving tons of debris in its sweep. As it merged with the mighty Cheat River, so named for the lives it has stolen, it scourged through St. George and gathered the bridge that had stood there since days of old, and smashed it to bits on the fields of the farms with never a thought or a care, then left Tucker County alone in the night, all ravaged so bleak and so bare. Oh, I could go on for verse after verse of destruction that November night, caused by an opponent so mighty and strong not even a giant could fight. Now the why and the for we never will know that took our green valley away. Could it be that the Lord sent a message that night, and in it he meant for to say, the treasures man builds on the soft of the sand can be gone in the wink of an eye, and all that remains is the love of a friend to comfort and hold while you cry. Oh, we will build back just as grand as before, and in time the memory will dim. When nature has healed all the scars of the flood, Tucker's Valley will be green again. But come each November, we'll pause and give thanks to the Lord for all that we have. And then we'll remember with hearts sad to cry the friends who perished in the flood of 85. This is a picture of my husband and I and the horse that we lost. I don't know if you can see that or not, but you can pass it around if you like. On the back side is a different kind of horse. It's my husband being a horse.
Was the horse ever found?
No, we never found him. We never found him at all. And I'm really rather glad that we didn't, because I really don't know if Norman could have handled it. There were lots of riding horses found, and once we even heard a rumor that there was a large workhorse found, and he went to look at it, and I was so thankful that it wasn't it. But after the flood, there was a group called Christmas in the Hills, and they sent us $50 toward him a new horse. So I put another $50 with it, and we bought a $100 colt. I took this picture and then exposed it a little bit to kind of make it look like an old one, so that's why it's dark. I wanted to see what would happen if I exposed it for just a second, and to make it look like an antique type picture. But this is a new horse. And I also wrote a poem about it, because I've always been amazed that the trust that builds up between a person who owns an animal and how they can make it do what they want it to do. Now, the big horse in that picture, my husband could do anything with him until he got ready to work. And when he wanted to work him to plow, or he made the hay with him and all this sort of thing. We used him. As a matter of fact, when we bought the farm, he sold a little old Alice Chalmers tractor that was there and bought that big horse. But whenever he got ready to work that horse, he couldn't catch it at all. It knew instinctively that when it was going to work. But I could go down to the fence and call the horse, and he'd come right up to me. But I couldn't do anything else with him. I was scared of him. And so I've always been a little awed by how people build up a trust between themselves and an animal. And this new colt that we got was so scared when we got it. It was only 7 months old. And it was so scared of everything. It's a part Belgian and a part Clydesdale. So after he brought the horse home, you can see in the picture already he was hugging it. So it's really amazing how soon the horse came to trust him. And that's why I wrote this poem. And I called it The Master's Touch. Oh, a man and his horse, it's a wonderful thing. The camaraderie that lies in between. The trust of the horse and the master who loves sets the mold and the cast it will bring. Once on wobbly legs, a horse colt ran free in a meadow all fragrant and green. Warm mother beside with the gentlest nudge and the song of a cool mountain stream. But he learned if he bit that mother would kick, and the bumblebee stung his soft nose. That the clover was sweet, but the thorns you can't eat on the shoots of a wild mountain rose. When he grew straight and strong, mother pushed him aside. Then man came with halter in hand, and he shivered in fear as the person drew near, but curiosity narrowed the span. Then the halter was slipped on his head, buckled firm as he stood, legs braced, nostrils flared. But soft words, gentle hands soothed his shivering sides, and he wondered, why should I be scared? Soon he learned that the man wouldn't hurt like the bee, or the thorn of the rose when he chewed. And the sweet taste of grain put aside thought of pain, and the trust between man and horse grew. Thus the lessons of life, much like that of the horse, man must learn in the fight to survive. With the master to lead us in trust through the field, the thorns won't cut quite so deep, and love's great rewards, like the grain for the horse, will replace the bitter with sweet. And I might report that he's doing very well now. Our horse is growing and just doing fine. And Norman is hauling rocks off of our meadow that used to be meadow. It's turned into like a riverbed, you know, and the Soil Conservation Service came and tried to smooth it up some. But I said, I know where the Great Wall of China is now. It's right there, because there's just rocks on top of more rocks. That they sowed it down, and there are some weeds growing. And so now he's picking the big rocks off, and we're going to try hauling some sand and whatever back up to put on it. And I wrote a poem about a little place that was up above ours, and I thought that, well, this one is rather sad, but it ends well, so maybe that will help. I haven't named this one, but I said, oh, will you walk a mile with me through cavalcade of time, back to before November's flood? We'll start where roses climbed, across the trellis that had sagged since builder moved from earth, and widow sold the land and left to seek an easier birth. I cannot see that trellis now, except in memory's eye. The flood washed even roots away. Oh, Lord, I wonder why. Come down the path a little way, see where the hollow lies. Once bluebells grew on every hand, and watercress did thrive. I could not see the flowers this spring, or the watercress that grew, except to look with eyes closed tight and in my memory view. And do you see this mighty trunk where once the giant oak gave cooling shade from summer sun? I cannot think it broke. And just around the bend away, there was a perfect place. Beneath a drooping pine, soft sand would hide you from life's race. That place is gone, and I don't know just where it even laid. The brutal rocks don't beckon me to walk along that way. Across the field of velvet green with daisies here and there, a sturdy log house graced by trees with all their fruits they shared. But I cannot see that cabin now. It's hard to tell it stood. There are no trees or velvet grass, just rocks and splintered wood. But one day time and nature will restore it all so grand. Someone will build the trellis back, and the roses will bloom in the sand. Most of our trees washed away, you know, the nice apple trees and all that just washed away. But there was this one big old dead cherry tree that's still standing there, a huge, huge old cherry tree. And the flood, you know, washed debris up all around it. And so my husband pushed some more against it and set it on fire, and it just was like a chimney. It just burned out the top. And the old tree still stood. But we were thinking about cutting it down, and I happened to notice right up in the very top of it, where there was a branch-like place, there was this little green sprout growing. And it wasn't from that tree. It was from another tree that a bird had carried the seed or something and dropped it there, I suppose, in some of that soft dead wood or whatever, and it grew. But it was so amazing that I wrote a poem about it, and I called it Roots. A gnarled old cherry tree stands by the door of new house we built near mountainside. It was ravaged by flood, burned in debris fire, and still the great hawk does abide. Limbs blackened and charred, it stretches far out like the ones on TV horror shows. With bony-like twigs and not hole for an eye, its top is jagged off against the blue sky. But strangest of all, nestled high on a limb, a tiny green tree grows from sprout, of a seed carried there by a wandering bird and dropped in a crevice, no doubt. And as I behold this marvelous sight of dead tree with its lifespan done, yet standing still firm, roots holding it tight, it supports the green sprout, but for short, shallow life. And I liken it now to so many good folk who plant their dreams high with great haste, and later discover the substance not there to neuter their dreams through life's race. For if we place dreams on life's shifting sands, without God's plan to hold fast, then just like the sprout on a limb without life, our dreams cannot flourish, just sprout up and die. I also wrote one about a quilt that I had started on, and after the flood, we found a part of it in the mud, and I washed the mud out of it and put it aside and thought maybe sooner or later I would finish it. And I called it the Quilt of Life. There's an unfinished quilt at my house because the flood washed the pieces away. I cleaned the mud from the part that was left with intent to finish it someday. And I spread it all out every once in a while when I come across cloth thought to match, then fold it back up and put it away for the lack of a suitable patch. For this piece is too dark or maybe too light, and the thickness may not be the same. The weave is too loose or maybe too close, and the quilt unfinished remains. But it serves to remind me when I grow sad about sorry hand fate has dealt, of the patchwork of life with the pattern unclear until we have finished the quilt. For one square is dark as a storm cloud shade, and one is as bright as new pin. But we need both the dark and the shiny bright to make the whole pattern blend. And even the colors won't hold it in place, for the shapes might not be the same. Like the crazy quilt that Grandma made, life often has edges to tame. But God planned life's quilt with the greatest of ease, like every good quilt maker does. And though he put in rough edges to trim, it will cover us safely with love. And the quilt at my house that flood ruined for a while might lay on the shelf many days, but sooner or later I'll fit pieces in, and the quilt will warm us, I pray. After we decided to build a house, we went over against the hillside where it was higher and had a place dozed out to build. Looked just fine, you know. We'd never seen any water coming out of that hill or anything. And after we had it dozed out, the next day there were four springs coming out of the side of this hill. And of course my husband was fit to be tied because he didn't know how to handle that, you know, and of course he was grumping at me, and I felt like almost jumping in the river, you know. I was really discouraged, so I just went down and sat down by that river and just glared at it, and I wrote this poem, and I called it My Escape. Have you ever felt so discouraged that you just said to heck with it all and sat down on a rock at the river's edge and glared at the mountains tall? Well, the smell of the river invades your soul, and the wind whips hair in your eyes. The soft sand squiggles between your toes, and a lazy old bass swims by. And you feel so alone in a world that's filled with more problems than anything else. The joy is gone, and nobody cares that you're sitting alone on life's shelf. But suddenly the cat brushes soft by your side with a purr that says, I love you, and demands that you make a lap of your legs for a friend who will sit there too. With the paw on your cheek, claws carefully concealed, he brushes a stray tear aside, then curls his body so warm in your lap, and at peace closes yellow-green eyes. A cloud passes over and covers the sun, but you don't feel the slight breeze's chill, for the dog has come too and laid down by your side, head on paws and perfectly still. A tiny bird hops a few feet away, head cocked with questioning eyes. A butterfly circles with gold wings outspread as she looks for a place to light. And it's then you realize you're not alone. God sent his creatures to care for the hurt in your heart and the spirits so low, the problems of life they will share. His perfect peace will restore the joy and give a new lift to your soul. And the comfort that comes from nature's own scene won't leave room for a self-pity hole. So you pick yourself up and dust off the sand. Cat and dog race ahead down the path, and you're glad that you had silent talk with the Lord. You can now face the world with a laugh. There was an old swinging bridge that was down below our house before the flood, and our women's club was working to restore this old bridge. And It had been built in 1917 and a couple of times it broke down, but had been rebuilt with the same materials. And so my husband's uncle looked out for this old bridge and also for the people that crossed it, because every year when we had the Hick Festival in Hendricks, this is a photograph of him, by the way, every year when we had the Hick Festival in Hendricks, a lot of children would go on this old bridge and jump up and down. Once I even caught them building a fire on it. I can't imagine what they were going to do with a fire on the bridge. And at one time I chased 30 kids off it, you know. And it was really getting rickety, even though we'd, you know, done some repairs and everything to it. But finally, no one claimed the old bridge, by the way. The town didn't claim it, the county didn't, the state didn't, and just no one, because it was built with public donations, you know. And I think someone said for $300 back in 1917. And it was 320 feet long. So you can imagine the materials must have been cheap at that time, because now they're saying, as a matter of fact, FEMA has allotted $30,000 to rebuild this bridge, and Swackard Engineering says that isn't nearly enough. So, I don't know. But anyway, every year when the Hick Festival came in, Norman's uncle Joe Long would go down and sit at that old bridge, because he was afraid that someone was going to fall off it, or the bridge would break down and kill a bunch of people. But a lot of people resented the fact that he was down there, you know, and they didn't like the fact that he was there on that bridge running their kids off, you know. And a matter of fact, a couple of people came up to him and said, you know, what business do you think you have sitting here telling everybody to stay off this bridge? And they said that he was just concerned about the bridge, but he would never say that. He would always say, if I don't go down and watch that bridge, someone might get killed. And the reason that he knew that this old bridge could break down was the fact that a bridge had broken down near his home when he was a young man, with his mother and father and I believe about 20 people on it. They were coming from a Christmas play, so it was really cold, you know, and there was ice in the water. And he helped to take everyone out that couldn't get out on their own at the river that night, except for one person that they couldn't find. And they felt that the cable must have hit her and maybe broke her neck or something, because she washed down the river. And I think they found her about a week later. But he even took his dad out twice, because he took his dad out and then he took his mother out, and his dad thought that his mother was still in there, so he jumped back in and he ended up taking him out twice. So I wrote this poem that I entitled The Old Man on the Bridge. The old man sat at the end of the bridge, his countenance weathered like stone, and the children whispered the old man is mad as he chased them away with harsh tones. And the town folk all said, what business is his to sit like a king at the end of the bridge? But the old man sat on all 3 days of the fair like a troll guarding his bridge. Folks passed one by one and no harm was done to the old swinging bridge or the town people's kids. And they all said, pshaw, that old bridge won't break down. We jumped on it when we were young. The old man is just mean, and that's how it seemed to those who passed by in a steady stream. But they didn't know that once long ago, when the old man was young and quite strong, on a cold winter's night by a lantern light, how he fought the dark river to save many a life. The bridge over Dry Fork broke down with a crowd. The river was running with ice. It tore at his clothes and his body half froze as he searched all that night until none could be found. And by his great courage, just one person drowned. But the old man is gone. He won't sit there this year. You can run, you can jump if you may. If the old bridge breaks down, no one will be there but the river's hard rocks, cold and gray. The shallow water won't cushion your fall, a tragedy, people will say. but they'll know why the old man sat at the bridge and chased the children away. And of course, he died in 1984, so he didn't see the flood. The bridge hasn't been built back yet. The Methodist Church and the Woman's Club together had a dinner to raise money for this old bridge, and I wrote this one to advertise it. The old bridge stands with a definite swag, where the cables are broken, the timbers have sagged. Its days are numbered, that's plain to see, when the waters are high and it groans in the lee of the rushing waves that pound on its piers and tremble the tower posts holding it fast to the rusted pins that just can't last much longer. Tear the old thing down, some folks say. Let it fall in the water and just wash away. The cost is too high to have it repaired, and what is the good of having it there, after all? But the old bridge is part of my past and yours. I walked it to school and you played on its shores. We explored both sides, crossed to mountain and town. Can we just step aside and let it fall down, gone evermore? Our ancestors built it and tended its care, but now they are gone and it's time for our share of hearts, hands, and money, its value to keep, for our heirs to walk and the countless feet to cross. The old swinging bridge with its history will stand if we all work together and follow a plan, and the town will be proud of the structure one day when all the others have just washed away. The tourists and artists will come from afar to walk on its span or to paint and admire. Such beauty as this must never be lost. If you love the old bridge, then help with the cause. We're having a dinner on the 7th of July in the Methodist Church on the riverside, so come join with us and show that you care enough to keep the old bridge swinging there. And we did raise $2,000 to replace that old bridge, but like I say, it washed away.
Can you tell us more about the Long family?
Well, I found an article that I was going to bring and share with you, and then I forgot it at home. It was a newspaper article where my husband's great-grandmother had died at the age of 104. We think that probably her grandfather came from England, or that vicinity, and probably took an Indian woman for his wife. Their names were, her father's name was Wyatt, so we feel that was probably an Indian name. And they lived in Pendleton County, but when she married my husband's great-grandfather, whose name was also Joe, they came across the mountain over into Middle Mountain and then on down the river to a place called Otter Creek. It's near the Otter Creek Wilderness area. And on top of this mountain, they built their house, and I think they raised, I believe it was 11 children. They raised all of their food and even carried food off to sell, you know, into Hendricks. They took eggs and butter and farm, you know, produce and that sort of thing, and walked all the way into Hendricks. It was about 3 miles down the mountain to Otter Creek and then probably another 5 miles on into Hendricks. And this article, I don't know how true this is, but it said up until she was 101 that she made a weekly trip into town. Now, I don't believe that that's the case. I really don't, knowing my husband and his people, I really don't believe that they would have come to town that often, probably once a month, because his mother and father are still living, and they live on top of Fork Mountain, which is just out of Parsons, and it's about 3 miles up to the top of that mountain, too, and they live very simply. They don't have electricity, just the past couple of years that they even got water in the house, and then their house burned down in January of 1986, and they lost everything they had. But the boys built them a house back, and of course now it's a nice little house. still without any electricity, and they probably wouldn't have it if it was offered, because I recall once when we had a cabin up there, the television people wanted to put a tower and I suppose some sort of a, I don't know if it was a satellite or what, but some sort of a television tower on their property. And in return for that, they would give them electricity, and they wouldn't have it. And someone bought my mother-in-law a gasoline urn, and she just tore the tank off of it and set it on the stove and heated it like a sad urn, you know, and used it that way. She wasn't about to put kerosene or gasoline or whatever it was in this urn. She was afraid of it. They're a little strange, but if you go there, I guarantee you won't leave without having something to eat. He is 87 and she is 88, and they still walk those 3 miles into Parsons, and unless they need a big bunch of flour or something, they don't buy a lot, just coffee and flour and baking powders and that sort of thing, you know. But unless they need a pretty good size load of that or feed for one of the animals or something, they carry it up. Dad has a sack he puts on his back and carries it up the mountain. And if they need a load of something, then of course my husband or one of his brothers haul it up. You almost have to have a four-wheel drive to get to where they live, though. And shortly after we were married, and I was like, you know, I was 17 when we got married, just a month past 17 when we got married. And I would imagine, we've been married 33 years, so I don't know how old his mother was, in her 50s anyway, you know, something like that. But we went up to help them stack oats, and she just worked me to pieces. I couldn't keep up with her at all, you know. So... She could work rings around me, and she still can walk rings around me. But like I say, they're really good people.
Did they always live at that place?
No. Before that, they lived right above where we live now, but against the hill. And the flood wouldn't have bothered them if they